afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, members of the Farallon Recorder Quartet shared details about their upcoming concerts in Palo Alto, Berkeley, and San Francisco. John Lenti, lutenist, providing some live open-air theme music today. We'll hear more from him as guest artist with the Farallon. Eric Stratman, the brains and organizing brawn behind Sing for America, shares information about Sing for America, a unique chorus comprised of amateurs and professionals created with the goal of fundraising for various organizations of the members' choosing. Eric will be in studio shortly. Their one performance-only concert is coming up on March 30th. Plus, actors Andrew Nance and Dana Zook talk about the new Conservatory Theater's Bay Area premiere of Yellow by Del Shores, now in its final 2 weeks. And to conclude, critic-at-large Peter Robinson muses on the forthcoming Day of St. Patrick. Stay with us. To have some live theme music for Open Air. We'll hear more from guest lutenist John Lenti, who's performing with Farallon later this hour. To start things off, well, the new Conservatory Theater is in its final 2 weeks of presenting the Bay Area premiere of Yellow by Del Shores, directed by the new Conservatory's founding artistic director, Ed Decker. Del Shores' writing is most memorable in the form of, well, campy Southern Gothic farces like Sordid Lives. Now, this lively writing is also center stage in this new play, Yellow, but there's a little bit more drama involved in this Vicksburg, Mississippi family. Here to discuss the play are two of the actors that are involved in the show, Andrew Nance, who plays the father, Bobby. For 18 years, Andrew was New Conservatory's conservatory director, now free to direct, act, and produce on his own schedule. Also, while he was at the New Conservatory, he acted in terrific productions of Doubt, I Am My Own Wife, and Love, Valor, Compassion. He was awarded the Best Actor in a Solo Performance among his awards for Virgins and Other Myths. Andrew was on this past fall wearing his director's hat for My Beautiful Laundrette, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to talk about Yellow. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
Dana Zook was last seen in the New Conservatory's stage as Kara in American Dream. She also performed in the world premiere of The Queen's Gambit at Faultline Theater, among other roles. She includes Sarah Jane Moore in Assassins as a favorite role and Diana in Lend Me a Tenor. And when she's not on stage, she runs a research company with her brother in the Bay Area, L.A., and New York. Dana, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
This is quite a ride we're getting in Del Shores' Yellow. We can't give away too much of the plot, but let's discuss the storyline first of Yellow.
You want to go?
Yeah, I don't want.
Well, it's about a Southern family, Bobby and his wife Kate, and they are very much in love after 19 years of marriage, and probably more, of course, before that in college or high school or both. And we have two amazing kids, and it's really kind of the perfect family. And then some things happen, which we can't quite reveal, unfortunately.
Right. Right.
But it tests the family.
And needless to say, there's a tremendous emotional arc that things at the end don't things start off one way and end a very different way as the play progresses.
Just like real life.
Just like real life, indeed. Dana, you play the mom in this family who has a secret that we can't reveal as part of the play. Tell us a little bit about playing this harried mom figure in Del Shores, and a little bit about Del Shores' writing. What appeals to you in it?
Although it is obviously very dramatic, it's also very funny, and that's fun to kind of go through all of that. It's an amazing cast, so it's really fun to work with everybody, and it's challenging, the emotional aspect of it, but as an actor, we love that kind of stuff. So I think Del Shores is a brilliant writer, very smart, very funny, very real. And Kate, in particular, is a very strong woman, and that's always appealing to me, personally.
Sure. Andrew, your character undergoes a bit of a transformation as well as part of the process. You're a proud father of one very, very energetic young woman as a teenager.
Yes, that's a good word for it, energetic.
Tremendous actress playing that.
Ali Haas.
Ali is just really a delight to see on stage, just a bundle of teenage energy. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, she is a tour de force, absolutely.
And your number one son, so to speak, is the focus of most of the play.
Yeah, Damian Matthews. He's sort of the perfect son. I think both mom and dad here just think he can do no wrong, and our daughter is just going through her teenage years, and she's, you know, hitting her emotional hormonal stride, and so we're not sure exactly what to do with her.
We've all got big smiles on our faces because Del's writing is just really ebullient, and he really captures this family so wonderfully.
It's very funny. I think both of us have a hard time keeping a straight face when our daughter's on stage having her moments.
It won the 2012 Los Angeles Drama Desk Drama Critics Circle Award for Best World Premiere Play. Was Del involved at all in this production?
He was. He came to, I believe, a couple of our rehearsals, and then he was at the first preview.
Oh, great.
The first two previews. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing to be able to talk to him and get his take on it. And he actually has a young daughter, and he sort of commented that, you know, he drew from that a lot for this, for our daughter's character. And he was great. He had a lot of input and a lot of support to give, and great guy.
And Andrew, you're working, Ed Decker is directing this production.
Right.
Did Ed see the LA production? You're a director yourself. How does that work, that kind of relationship on stage?
Ed does like to see a lot of the work that he brings to New Conservatory. So I'm guessing he did see that production, but I can't swear to it. But he worked very closely with Del. He would call, email. They've known each other for years. So Del was always an email or a phone call away. So that was really nice. And
a luxury to be able, absolutely. You know, when we had questions about the script, he'd say, well, let me call Del.
Right. Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah.
That's Dana Zook, who's starring as Kate in Yellow, along with Andrew Nance, starring as Bobby, the father, in this drama, comedy drama, emotional arc, as I was mentioning, must be tremendous to go through every night. You're midway through the run now. What have you learned?
Well, that we can do this run. We were worried. We thought, you know, one day we're just not going to be able to hit these arcs. And so far, knock wood,
we have been
able to every night go right there to that emotional place many times throughout the play. And it's really cathartic, I think. And it really makes you feel like you're an artist, you know. We're really trying as an ensemble to just tell our story and be the artists up there working hard at creating these people, almost independently of the audience's experience, because it just takes you out of the moment if you start worrying about, you know, the person in the front row wiggling their foot, or someone coughing, or someone rushing out of the theater, you know, and, you know, because there's just too many stories to be told in your head.
Sure.
You start worrying about that.
You got two more weeks of the run. Has anything changed in your perception either of your characters or the way that you're interacting from show to show, or is it pretty much settled?
We have all settled in, but it does continue to change throughout. And I think that as we've gotten more comfortable with it and learned how the audience will respond in certain places, we've gotten better at just connecting with each other and really listening to each other and what the other person's saying, and that helps a lot with such an emotional show, to really, like Andrew said, be in the moment and really hearing what's being said rather than thinking, ooh, do they like us? Are they going to laugh? Are they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just last night, I realized the more I can really have my son be one of the loves of my life, the better off I am at the end of the play. So that was really, I mean, it seems obvious, but because of course I've always loved the kid, but last night I just realized it's just so important for him to just treasure him.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned that you're the son, we mentioned Damien, we mentioned Allie as playing the daughter. There's another family involved in this drama. Yes. I'm wondering if you could tell us about the other characters and your other colleagues in the play.
Go ahead. Sister Timothea is the mother of Kendall.
And Lindsay yes. Rousseau plays Sister Timothea.
And Andre Sanchez. He's in the program as Maurice Andre Sanchez. Right. We call him Andre.
Yeah, sure.
Or Kendall, depending on where we are. He is the son, and she is a Pentecostal, very...
Zealot.
Very religious...
Choose your words carefully. Oh,
I know. Over the top. She and Kate clash a lot, so there's a lot of tension there. I don't even know what else to say.
And her son, Kendall, in the play, sort of takes refuge in our house because he finds it so hard to be around her because he's very theatrical. He wants to be in the school play. She, of course, frowns on that and, really wants him to see the light. And so there's a lot of friction there. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just one more layer to add to all the drama that's mm-hmm. going on.
Right. Well, as I mentioned, you go through quite an emotional experience every night. How do you prepare for that? Can you do anything else when you do the show on a day like that?
It's tough. I don't know. There are things to prepare, but I find it better if I just sort of dive in and, again, be in that moment and think about exactly what I'm talking about, because it is very emotional, the words that we're saying and the situation that's going on. So I find it a little harder after to kind of come down from that, because it's a lot. It's a lot of emotion, and it's hard to sort of let that go
right
after.
Right.
Yeah, often during the curtain call,
yeah,
every actor on stage is still in a state.
Right. And and we have to stress, too, that it's a very enjoyable night at the theater.
Yeah, it really is.
A lot of laughs are made as mm-hmm. well, but it's a lot of emotion going on.
Yeah. It's about hope and, and family and love.
Forgiveness.
And there's a spirituality to the play that's quite astounding, I think.
It's called Yellow by Del Shores. It's at the New Conservatory Theater through the 23rd of this month. Information at the New Conservatory's website,
nctcsf.org.
Right in front of me. I need to give a little shout out for the set designer, because it's absolutely beautiful, effective use of space, very attractive on the eyes, with great attention to detail. Yeah. Who is the production designer?
Yes, Kuo-Hao Lo was our production designer, and Devin Casper built it, and he did a great job. There's a full house on stage.
Two-story
house. There's a porch. It's quite...
A bedroom, stairways. It's mm-hmm. just all works
kitchen.
So well in such a complex space.
My wife cooks me breakfast every evening at around 8:15.
And I think the lights have a huge part to do with it. Christian
Mejia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does the lights.
Did a great job.
So, it's a great team that they have there.
Well, I wish you a terrific run. Dana Zook, Andrew Nance, thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you so much.
Again, the show is Yellow at the New Conservatory Theater. Information at nctcsf.org. Still to come, a talk at the end of the hour with Peter Robinson about St. Patrick's Day. Eric Stratman will talk about Sing for America. And next, members of the Farallon Quartet. Stay with us here on Open Air. Thank you. is music written by Henry VIII from the Farallon Recorder Quartet's latest album, From Albion's Shore. The Farallon Recorder Quartet is a California-based early music group that specializes in music of the medieval, Renaissance, Baroque, and modern eras. They employ a fascinating array of recorder sizes ranging from 6 inches to 6 feet tall, modeled after the Baroque and Renaissance originals. Now, I love this description of their most recent CD that we just heard a snippet of. Early America calls it the sound one would get if one could turn honey into wood or stand underneath a caramel fountain. Lovely description. That's one for the record books in terms of visualization. Several members of this ensemble join me now in studio. Louise Carslake teaches early music performance on the faculty of Mills College and coaches Baroque flute at UC Berkeley, among other activities. She's toured extensively in her native Britain, as well as in New Zealand, Poland, Ireland, and the Netherlands. Louise, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
And Annette Bauer, who has been studying, in addition to the Baroque arts, she's been studying North Indian classical music, in addition to appearing as guest soloist with leading early music ensembles throughout the United States. She's also toured with the Cirque du Soleil show, Totem. Annette, welcome to Open Air.
Hello.
So the program is entitled Amaryllis, a program of love songs and consorts performed by the Farallon Quartet with soprano Jennifer Paolino and lutenist John Lenti, who we heard at the beginning of the program, and we'll welcome back in just a moment. I'm wondering how this title came up, Amaryllis. Louise, can you enlighten us?
Well, the final piece on our program happens to be called Amaryllis, and we thought it was suitable because Amaryllis was often the name of a nymph in the Renaissance, who seemed to be someone that everybody fell in love with. And so many of these songs are love songs, either from England or from Italy or Spain. So it seemed a good sort of title for the whole program.
Mm-hmm. And how did this program come together? Is it music that you researched yourself, that you found on your own, or is it something that...
A lot of it. We actually were given a grant by the San Francisco Friends of Chamber Music to develop this program. It's something we had wanted to do for a long time. We'd played together as a recorder quartet for many years, and we'd always been interested in working with a singer and a lute player. But putting it together was a fairly big task, just getting music that would work and that was suitable for the combination. The Renaissance is a great time for this because so much instrumental music was developing at that time. There were consorts of viols, consorts of recorders, consorts of flutes, and yet a lot of the music is vocal. So it's a good repertoire to do with one voice and instruments. Much of the music was published as apt for viols or voices or instruments or voices, and a lot of it was arranged for lute as well. So this was a great period of music to explore.
And Louise, did you come to recorder as an original instrument? Was that your first instrument? How did you end up in a recorder ensemble of all things?
Well, I learnt recorder as a child, which most people do in England. I then studied flute and Baroque flute.
So far we're the same path. In fourth grade I was on recorder, then went to flute. Am I going to go to recorder?
Recorder. You should do, yes. And so after Baroque flute, it was very easy to come back to recorder again and play recorder. And I've always loved Renaissance music, so this was a great way to play it.
And Annette Bauer, you seem to have some interest in the North Indian end of music, but how did you come to the Baroque aspect of performance?
Similar to Louisa's path and your path as well. I started as a child, as a 5 or 6 year old in Germany, playing the recorder, kind of, the way that a lot of children learn it, as a quote unquote introductory instrument. And I just happened to have teachers that really kept opening doors and repertory. And because of the instrument, early music was really the first repertory that I, discovered. And, so it's kind of like first love and really love an instrument that I've loved throughout my life and that I've worked with, ongoing.
Sounds like recorder is like the gateway drug to other instruments for everyone here. It's amazing. Yeah.
So the early music, Renaissance, Baroque, and then also I have some projects that go even further back into medieval European time period, but all kind of channeled through exploring it on the recorder, on different styles of recorder instruments, different models.
Nice. I'd also like to introduce more properly John Lenti, who provided our theme music. He's one of the guest artists as lutenist for these concerts presented by the San Francisco Early Music Society this weekend. John is a graduate of the North Carolina School of the Arts and Indiana University. His playing on theorbo, lute, arch lute, and baroque guitar has been described as a joy to behold, and we're very joyful that he agreed to provide some live music here. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you.
Welcome back to Open Air.
Thanks a lot. Nice to be back.
I'm wondering if, before we hear some more of the Farallon's music, you could offer us a little bit of solo lute.
Oh, sure. What I'll play for you is a little bitty Romanesca. It's kind of a harmonic formula for the recitation of love poetry. And this is an anonymous one from England, about 1570.
Major ending to that piece. John Lenti on lute. John, I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that. Hold the lute up to the microphone a little bit so people can have a look at that. It's got a lot of strings. I'm wondering how you keep those fingers from colliding on your left hand.
Well, it's got kind of a lot of strings, I suppose. It has 15 of them, but I play them as though they're 8. The strings, 7 of the strings are, or 7 of the 8 strings that I imagine, or that I see in my mind, are doubled strings. So they're paired pretty close together. Mm-hmm. It takes a little getting used to if you're accustomed to playing the guitar, but, it's a fairly easy jump for your brain to make to just say, well, instead of hitting one string, I'll hit two. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So tell us about your involvement in preparing this program.
Well, for me, it's a really, really wonderful opportunity to play Renaissance ensemble music at a high level. Things like this don't really happen all that often for lute players. A lot of us get into the business because we love Renaissance music. Usually the gateway drug for us is we're guitar players, and then we discover John Dowland the music of Elizabethan England. And so you fall in love with the Renaissance, and then you discover Josquin and earlier composers whose polyphony you want to be a part of, but there are relatively few opportunities to do that. What happens in this Farallon program is that there are a few numbers where there's an explicitly notated lute part, like we're playing 3 pieces by John Dowland as part of the concert, and in those cases I just get to play lute music written by John Dowland while the recorders play the consort lines. They play their parts, and we've got a singer, Jennifer Paulino, wonderful soprano, singing. And so in those cases I don't actually have to think much. I just do what's in front of me, but for a lot of the other numbers on the program, I just have the scores, so I have all the parts that are being played in front of me, and what I have to do is contrive some means of just adding a little bit of sparkle or a little bit of tinkle to the texture. So the recorders are very smooth, very vocal, and I have the kang, the chick, the
right.
The consonants.
And is that, I'm curious about the notation of from Dowland's time to today. And was that something that you had to relearn in terms of looking at music of that era?
Well, you know, for Dowland in particular, his stuff is very conveniently written in a form of tablature that just tells me exactly where to put my fingers. It's hard at first, but then all of a sudden it's a lot easier than anything else. For all the other music that we're playing, we're mostly working from editions that were prepared, I think, mostly by Louise, which are incredibly readable and very, very helpful. All of us who play this music work at some point or another from facsimile editions and from original part books and things like that, and we adore it. But we're all secretly happy when someone hands us a nice, clean, modern edition that we don't have to figure out.
Louise, I'm wondering if you could address that. Are you using a modern computer notational software for your work now?
Well, sure, yeah. Most of us do. But we have actually gone back to original sources a lot for what we're doing. But very often, just because of the range of what we're doing, we have to transpose things or put things in slightly different different arrangements for the quartet. So most of it ends up in one of our computers, and then we can tweak it as we need to fit the instruments and to work.
You're still able to see in those original source materials in your mind's ear how it should sound, though. Yes. From reading the scores,
Then
you just adapt the voicing depending on the instruments you're using with.
Exactly.
Very nice. So tell us about some of the range of recorders that you are personally playing in this concert.
Well, we have, as you mentioned, we have instruments from 6 inches tall to the very largest one. So the recorders sort of fall into two groups. We have what we call the 8-foot instruments, which are the larger ones and play at 8-foot pitch, and then the smaller ones, which play an octave higher than they are written. So a lot of the music we are using the big instruments. And so in that set, I am playing what is called a bass recorder. Actually, I'm playing the second line down. I'm playing the alto part on the bass recorder. So all the instruments are the lower ones. And then other pieces we're playing at what we call 4-foot pitch, which is the higher range. And personally, I like playing the bass, so I play the larger instruments.
And are all the recorders in the same key or not? Are they
no.
They sing in different keys. So
they're in different keys. They are actually a copy of a set that's in the museum in Vienna, a copy of a set of Renaissance recorders. So some of them are in the key of C, some of them are in the key of F, some of them are in the key of G. So it's... takes some getting used to. Mm-hmm.
That's Louise Karslake along with Annette Bauer. Annette, are you also going from instrument to instrument in this concert?
Yes, I switch as well from different sizes within the consort. I'm kind of in this program. I'm mostly in either on a tenor or on an alto instrument. So kind of in the medium to higher range of the sounds.
Mm-hmm. Annette Bauer along with Louise Karslake. Guest John Lenti and soprano Jennifer Paulino are involved in the San Francisco Early Music Society's concert called Amaryllis. The rest of the quartet is Letitia Berlin and Francis Blaker. Should be a wonderful program. The concert on Friday is in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, Sunday in San Francisco. Information at the San Francisco Early Music Society website, sfems.org. John was alluding to some John Dowland earlier, and we've got some Dowland that is going to be a part of this program. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the work that's called Can She Excuse My Wrongs?
Well, this is it's a wonderful piece. It's very, very lively. Dowland's kind of interesting because he wrote his music in various forms. It can either be sung with voice and lute, or he also wrote it in a sort of consort form, which means that you have instruments playing the other lines. And so in this, the version that we will be playing on at the weekend, we've kind of incorporated both forms, and we've also incorporated some of the ornaments that he wrote for the lute into our recorder version of it. So you'll hear that it's some voice and lute, and then sometimes the instrument play along with it as well.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that, and we'll chat a little bit more. Can She Excuse My Wrongs? Music of John Dowland, performed by the Farallon Recorder Quartet.
Thank you.
Can She Excuse My Wrongs? Music of John Dowland, sung there by Jennifer Paulino, with guest John Lenti, as both as guests of the Farallon Recorder Quartet. You can hear that work along with others on the theme of Love Songs and Consorts, a program called Amaryllis, presented by the San Francisco Early Music Society this weekend. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with you for Open Air, joined once again by Annetta Bauer and Louise Karslake, two of the members of the Farallon Quartet. That's some really lovely, lovely music. So tell us just a little bit more about how things are themed in this program, Amaryllis.
Well, each section is from a different country. We have several sections from England, actually. We also have a wonderful four pieces by Josquin des Prez, some instrumental, some vocal as well. And Arcadelt is an Italian composer who's rather interesting because he, the piece that we are playing by him, O Felici Occhi Miei, a composer called Diego Ortiz from Spain wrote divisions on that piece. So you will hear the piece sung in its original form and then with the divisions or variations played on recorders. So it's rather a nice connection to the vocal version and the instrumental version. We have some other divisions for recorders in the program as well.
Great.
So it's a lot of variety, lots of virtuoso recorder playing, beautiful love songs. It's a really enjoyable, varied program.
Well, I'm sure we'll get some people there for it, and I'd love to attend myself. The concerts are Friday in Palo Alto at the First Lutheran Church on Homer Avenue, Saturday in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian, and on Sunday in San Francisco, a 4 p.m. concert at St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Louise Karslake, Annetta Bauer, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about this wonderful program.
Thanks for having us here.
Thank you.
Of course. I wish you a fantastic performance. And I'm going to impose on John Lenti, who is going to be the guest lutenist as part of this program, to provide a little outro music. John, what are we going to hear?
You're going to hear a little bit of Nampha Napa, which is a wonderful piece by Josquin that will be on the program in a lute arrangement by Simon Ginsler, who was a German who lived in Italy and arranged Josquin for lute.
There you go. Here we go. Performing lute. You can hear him as part of the San Francisco Early Music Society concert Amaryllis, a program of love songs and consorts performed by the Farallon Recorder Quartet, along with guest soprano Jennifer Paulino. Concert information this weekend in Palo Alto, Berkeley, and San Francisco at the San Francisco Early Music Society's website, sfems.org. Still to come, a chat with Eric Stratman about Sing for America, and Peter Robinson will be talking a little bit about the St. Patrick's holiday coming up. The place to be on Sunday, March 30th, just 2 weeks away at 7 p.m. at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater, is the Sing for America 2014 benefit concert. Here to talk about that is Eric Stratman. Native San Francisco, Eric native San Franciscan, Eric Stratman, has been singing with the San Francisco Opera Chorus for 25 years. Both of his parents sang with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus. And as a soloist, Eric has sung for United States presidents, secretaries of state, prime ministers, along with an occasional chancellor or governor along the road. Eric was director of finance for the San Francisco Boys Chorus for 15 years and brings that business acumen that was honed in the halls of UC Berkeley to Sing for America, an organization he founded in 2012 and for which he is founder, director, and president. Eric, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, Dave.
So, how did you come up with the idea for Sing for America?
Well, a lot of what I did with the Boys Chorus, aside from managing the money, was to try to find money. And I had some basis in development, raising money for a school. And one morning I was watching Sunday morning CBS with Charlie Osgood, and he had an article or a film about singing in choruses in America and how 30 million Americans sing, adult Americans, sing in choruses, including important business people, and it spanned the entire political and economic range, socioeconomic range of the United States. And I know personally about being addicted to singing in choruses because I've sung in two choruses since I was 18. And that's a long time. So I put that together with my interest with fundraising, because I use fun as a way to raise money. Raising money is just not something that anybody looks forward to. But people do look forward to singing.
And they look forward to the end result of that fundraising.
Yeah, so that if you can meld the two functions of singing and having a good time raising money. My experience had been in presenting events where people came, the audience came, and had a great time. And so they were happy to share the experience and the funds required. So I always aim for that kind of an experience. Our concert on the 30th will be very much that way, where the audience will leave thoroughly, having thoroughly enjoyed themselves. So my experience in my own fundraising and in this always means bring the joy together. So now the chorus singers in this experience get to join our chorus and raise money at the same time, just as if they were running a marathon. I'm not an exercise guy. I don't run marathons. I don't remember the last time I exercised. Singing itself is, of course, a very healthy thing.
Of course, yes.
And so you get to come and sing in our chorus, and at the same time, we give you a webpage to raise money, very much like a marathoner or a bicyclist or a walker would do for breast cancer or some other charity. But in this case, in this instance, you get to pick the charity. So we're melding self-interest of wanting to sing and self-charitable interest in wanting to raise money for your cause, not our cause. So you can come, and then your beneficiary, if they're really smart, can recognize your effort on their behalf, and they can come to the event and buy a ticket, such as parents in a school or members of a chorus or members of an orchestra. They can come and buy a ticket, and part of the funds from the ticket purchase will go to their cause as well.
Oh, I see. So part of the proceeds from the concert, and most of the fundraising is done prior to the concert.
Right.
But the concert proceeds is also similarly divvied up to these charities of choice.
Absolutely. I think self-interest is the greatest motivator. And if we can build an audience based on, number one, enjoying the concert, which is just going to be terrific from our last rehearsal, but also from self-interest of aiding a charity or aiding your own charity. Mm-hmm. I'm a big capitalist that way.
Right. Well, are there any organizations that you would not want to benefit? Suppose someone wanted to raise money for NRA or the Tea Party. Is it open game for them to come and sing for the Tea Party?
I mean, in 3 years, we haven't faced that issue yet. But I'm assuming we're going to face it at some point. I just haven't thought about that.
Well, I'm sure lots of money. Do you have any idea how much has been raised this year so far for various causes?
Yeah, on the online process, we have about $60,000 raised. And then we'll sell approximately $20,000 worth of tickets. And then we have an additional fundraiser, which was the foundation of our organization, where major donors come to an event. And we'll probably net close to $95,000 to $100,000 at that event.
Fantastic.
And at some point, then the choral function, when we hit 200 singers and we have reached a critical mass where people are bringing their friends to sing, we will surpass the other event. I mean, at some point, we want to have the, you know, if I live long enough, I'd love to see a chorus in Santa Rosa and a chorus over in Walnut Creek and a chorus in South Bay and one in San Francisco using the same talent that we bring in from around the country, but having it go on a circuit like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday night and doing the same program but for 800 to 1,000 singers.
Right, right. Right. And this ensemble has only been in existence for this concert, is that correct?
Right. Every year we start afresh. We can depend upon some of the members of the San Francisco Opera Chorus who join us so that we have a professional bass singing right next to bank chairman and helicopter pilots. And we actually have 3 helicopter pilots on our chorus.
Wow. That could be noisy.
But we have our own transportation.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. That's the way to go. So tell me a little bit about your musical guests that you have. Marcus Lovett, a wonderful Broadway star. I think he's still in London as the Phantom. Had a long run of the Phantom here in New York. And as well, you're having a Metropolitan Opera soprano, Marie Plett. How did these folks get involved?
It's just...
ask them the question.
And not necessarily me. We have every year you see who floats to the top in being an eager bunny in this organization. And so we had one singer last year who'd never raised money in her life, and that was Buffy Baggett. And she took to this like a duck to water, and she raised money for Berkeley West Edge Opera. And with enthusiasm. I mean, some people were afraid. She went out there and got on Facebook and just cranked away. And so we favor those people. And so we've now enrolled Buffy into our staff. And so she's our communications expert. And she knows Marie and another friend in the opera knew Nicole Foland, who's joining us. And so we've got some, I mean, 4 regular singers in the community come to sit down next to these real horses who are just cranking out the sound. It's a killer. They're just blown away by being able to sit next to these people.
Very nice. And how is this orchestra formed then? It's with full orchestra.
Well, we started by hiring people. We always believe in that the professional artists who are always short on money as it is need to get some kind of compensation. So we hired our orchestra. But then we started getting volunteers. We have opera orchestra volunteers. Chris Borg from the Community Music Center has volunteered. So as we may end up with all volunteer fundraising orchestra people, too, in a couple of years.
And so part of the proceeds go not only to these charities, but to the ensemble, to the organization, Sing for America, so it can self-perpetuate as well.
Not Sing for America, but certainly to the artists. Out of a budget of $200,000 or so that will gross this year, I would say $30,000 would go to the incidentals like, and they're not incidentals, but insurance, accounting, and a lot of that sort of stuff. Staff.
It takes a village to put on a concert, that's for sure.
Yeah, and then we have another $30,000 or so that goes to the non-artistic costs of running a theater and the rehearsal space and that sort of thing.
Very nice. So what else is going to be on the program? There's a variety of both classical and Broadway stylings going on. I understand something by David Conte is also going to be on
the
program?
Yeah, we have two compositions by David Conte, who came in last Monday night and conducted a rehearsal, which it's always a refreshment to have somebody replace the regular guy you've seen every week, and David really sparked everybody's attention. And so he has his segment, and we have Marie Plett doing a couple of arias. We have Seanette Sulker doing this is a voice that just spirals to the heaven, and she's the shortest person with the biggest voice I've ever met. And we have Alex Tate, who joins her in singing a couple of spirituals. So we have the
something
opera
for everyone.
We have a Broadway. Yeah. We have Americana. We have opera.
And you're just the P.T. Barnum to get it all together. That's fantastic.
Oh, God.
It's a lot of work, I know. Well, Eric, we wish you a fantastic concert. The concert is Sunday, March 30th. We mentioned earlier that this is a fluid ensemble. If someone wanted to be involved in next year's Sing for America concert, how would they be involved as a singer or a participant?
Well, they probably know somebody, but we have info@singforamerica.org, sort of a standard email for most organizations. So info@singforamerica.org. And we're going to start recruiting right away. We're not going to let these guys go, you know, we're not going to drop them for 8 months. We're going to start nailing them down for next year. And I really hope to have 200 singers next year.
Every best wish to you. Sunday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Palace of Fine Arts. Information at singforamerica.org or tickets at cityboxoffice.com. Thanks so much for coming in, Eric.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Oh, Paddy dear, and did you hear the news that's going round? The shamrock is by law forbid to grow on Irish ground. St. Patrick's Day no more will keep, his colours can't be seen. For they're hanging men and women for the wearing of the green. I met with Nabertandy and he took me by the hand. He said, how's dear old Ireland and how does she stand? She's the most distressful country that you have ever seen. For the hanging men and women, for the wearing of the green. For the wearing of the green, for the wearing of the green. They're hanging men and women for the wearing.
The Wolftones for the wearing of the green. Here to talk about all things St. Patrick is our own little saint, Peter Robinson. Hi, Peter.
Well, thank you for the beatitudes and the sanctification. Because yeah. It's this time of year, you know, with St. Patrick's Day coming up, that I always get a call from my Aunt Mag, who is 91, lives in County Cork, and always begins the conversation with more or less the same thing. And it'll begin, I sure St. Patrick's Day is coming up now. Don't you think it's time to come home? And I said, come home. And then she has her three standard Irishisms, which I could almost recite verbatim. She says, now the Irish don't know what they want and are prepared to fight to the death to get it. And I'm sure that's true about you. And I say yes as I nod my head. And her other one is, the Irish gave the bagpipes to the Scots as a joke, but the Scots haven't seen the joke yet. And there's no disrespect to anybody who plays bagpipes, because indeed the Irish are very fair people. They never speak well of one another. Now, speaking of that, St. Patrick himself is one of these mysterious, enigmatic saints. In fact, the facts about his life are remarkably few. Most derived from two documents, which he probably wrote, the Autobiographical Confessions and the Indignant Letter to a Slave. But one of the ironies about St. Patrick, in fact, he was born in Britain, probably in Wales. His father was a Roman official, and when he was 16, raiders or pirates, seafaring raiders, captured him and carried him off to Ireland and sold him into slavery. At that point, the Christian Patrick spent six lonely years herding sheep and, according to him, praying 100 times a day. Then, this always happens to the Irish, in a dream, God told him to escape. He returned home, and then he had another vision in which the Irish people begged him to return and minister to him. We asked the boy, come and walk among us once more, he recalls in his confessions. He went on to study for the priesthood in France and then made his way back to Ireland. So when you have that scattered type of biography where the facts are few, St. Patrick can become all things, if necessary, to all men and all women. In fact, he did spend 30 years baptizing pagans, ordaining priests, founding churches and monasteries, and his persuasive powers must have been astonishing, since Ireland became a fully converted country to Christianity within 200 years and was the only country in Europe to Christianize peacefully. So that's how it was, but how is it today? And I think this is where the transformation becomes more interesting, because in 1737 in Boston, we actually had the first Irish immigrants parade. And once it came to this country, it became, I hate to say it, a marketing operation. So in 1762, New York hosted its first parade, and now today certainly hosts the biggest and the most important of all, the St. Patrick's Day happenings. And this year, St. Patrick's Day looks as though it's going to be bigger than ever before. From Dublin to Tokyo, there are celebrations. For example, if you're in Paris, the Sleeping Beauty's castle in Disney World is going to dress itself up in green. And if for any reason you're in Petra in Georgia, in Jordan, they're going to have a special global greening this year. So it's not just Dublin, it's not just Boston, it's not just Chicago, it's not just Buenos Aires, it's not just Belfast. Munich in Germany has an annual parade, and this year's march ends at the city's centre with Irish music and dance. If you go to London, England, they have taken over, or will be taking over, Trafalgar Square, with 100,000 people expected to turn up, and the Big Eye, or the London Eye as they call it, is going to go green this year. So if we actually look at the different ways what began as a pre-medieval saint and the imagery that has come with it, incidentally, it's very unlikely that St. Patrick banned the state snakes from Ireland because there were no snakes to start with. And the shamrock, he didn't turn into the Trinity. That was a fabrication from the 19th century. So amongst these myths and amongst these different, what I call maybes, could-bes or would-beens, St. Patrick's Day today, or this next week today, will be a time to celebrate.
Well, I'm wondering if the four-leaf clover also fares into any sort of mythology that you're aware of.
Well, I think the mythology is I'm looking over.
Yes, indeed.
I'm looking over a four-leaf clover. So I think it became one of those lyrics from a song that actually gave it its meaning, because the technically three-leaf clover is the one that you actually find in the ground, and there are other names for the others. Now, I did mention that I will be taking a trip, and for anybody who is going to Ireland, I have six places that you don't want to miss. The Cliffs of Moher, just a beautiful scenic walk which takes you along the Atlantic Ocean on the western coast. The Rings of Kerry, the Giant's Causeway, the Skellig Islands, and of course the Aran Islands, where that famous cardigans and wool comes from. And then, indeed, there is Dublin itself. And if you go to Dublin, you want to go to Trinity College, go to Dublin Castle, and of course don't forget what I call the Guinness Factory. Now, I think no piece of Irish folklore or history would be complete without an Irish ditty. So to all those, including anyone on the Brendan Tours who've been telling me where they're going to take you this year, here's a few lines of Irish poetry to warm the cockles of your Irish heart. 'Twas an evening in November that I very well remember. I was walking down the street with drunken pride, when my knees went all aflutter, and I ended in a gutter, and a pig came up and sat down by my side. As I lay there in the gutter, tinking torts I could not utter, a colleen walking by was heard to say, "You can tell a man who boozes by the company he chooses." And the pig got up and quietly walked away. So there you have it. A happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. And don't forget about the wearing of the green. But if you're Irish, come into the parlour.
Thank you, Peter.
If you're Irish, come into the parlour. There's a welcome there for you. And if your name is Timothy or Pat, so long as you come from Ireland, there's a welcome on the mat. If you come from the mountains of Mourne or Killarney's lake so blue, we'll sing you a song and make a fuss. Whoever you are, you're one of us. If you're Irish, this is the place for you. The parlor, there's a welcome there you come from Ireland, there's a welcome on the mat. If you come from the Mons of Mourn or Killarney's lakes all blue, we'll sing you a song and make a fuss. Whoever you are, you're one of us. If you're Irish, this is the place for you.
Ruby Murray singing If You're Irish in celebration of the forthcoming St. Patrick's Day. Speaking of which, if you're interested in the San Francisco St. Patrick's Day March, it takes place this Saturday at 11:30, beginning at 2nd and Market, all the way to Civic Center. After you get to Civic Center, you might want to hang out a little bit, have a little bit of green beer. And then if you're having some dinner and need some evening entertainment, well, Saturday, March 15th is also the first Davies Symphony Hall appearance of French soprano Nathalie Dessay. She's appearing at Davies Symphony Hall in a program of French songs and German Lieder. You will want to catch that if you are able. I'm David Latulip. You've been listening to Open Air, a reminder that our programs are archived at our website, kalw.org. Big thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show and setting the calendar. If you've got a guest suggestion or a program idea, send it to me, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening, and happy St. Patrick's to one and all.